Patricio Grassini, assistant professor and water for food and institute fellow with the Department of Agronomy and Horticulture at the University of Nebraska. His presentation is on assessing the impact on farm management practices on soybeans.
Well, you know, that's the trade-off between asking for an abstract 6 months in advance and, you know, but you have on mind during that time. So, yeah, anyway, thank you very much, John and Jessica, for the invitation to present at this session. And today I will try to convince you about the value of using on-farm databases for benchmarking productivity and environmental footprint of crop systems. This is going to be the conceptual framework that I will use along the presentation. We have a yield potential for a given year, for a given field, which is determined by the light during the growing season, the temperature, the carbon dioxide, the choice of cultivar that the farmer made, and for dryland crops, also water supply, distribution, and some soil properties also will set an upper limit to how much yield can be produced in a given acre of land. On the right side now, we have the on-farm yield, which is typically well below what will be the potential for that same field and same year, because in most cases, yield is constrained by other limiting or yield-reducing factors, including nutrient supply, biotic pressure, and general poor management. And the difference between the yield potential and the on-farm yield is what we call the yield gap. And pretty much all my research going on now and during the last 3 and 4 years has to do with trying to measure the size of that gap and trying to identify opportunities to eventually narrow it. And that's a quite important question because, in a way, the yield gap is telling us how far we are from what can be potentially produced on that piece of land following optimal management versus what we get now. And from another angle, that also tells us what will be the untapped potential for increasing grain production in a given region. So understanding the size and the causes of that yield gap at different spatial scales is quite important to make sure that in 30, 20 years from now, we will be able to feed a world with 11 billion people with stretching water resources and land. So the typical approach that have been used in the past for identifying causes for the gaps is just to run on-farm trials or experiments at research stations where we have omission plots or control plots and we test something or we exclude something, and by difference we can tell how much of that gap that I showed before can be explained by that factor. The disadvantage of this type of approach is that in many cases it requires to run these trials over a large number of sites and years before you can get something clean out of it. Likewise, it's getting quite expensive over time to run these trials, and we all know that. And then finally, and that's quite interesting, is that in some cases, running these trials will require so many years and so many sites that by the time we can get something clean out of this and make a recommendation, it may be the case that farmers have already moved into that just because of their own expertise, their own skills, and their own fine-tuning of the cropping management. So the question is, how can we move from this type of research that is kind of expensive, requires a lot of effort, a lot of sites, and in many cases is more like a forensic job rather than an exploratory type of research. So how can we improve this? How can we complement it? How can we better strategize how to run field trials? So what I would like to propose here is to use farmers' reported data as a way to benchmark cropping systems and better orient our research agenda. Because in a way, having a good number of having data from a large number of producers' fields over a large number of years is equivalent to running thousands of field studies to capture soil by climate by management interactions. This information can help us to identify causes of yield gaps within the actual cropping systems. It really portrays the cropping systems. We don't have this issue that how can I extrapolate the results from my site year specific experiment to a larger spatial scale. So in a way, it's more representative of the range of things that farmers are doing in their fields. I hear from the previous presenter that, yeah, why to include a tillage system if pretty much all farmers now follow no-till? So that's the kind of things that we believe that farmers' data can help to answer, because we are looking to optimizing things within the range that farmers are actually doing in their fields nowadays. It's very cost-effective, it has a very low cost. And another angle or another advantage of this approach is that if you can keep a track of some key metrics related with cropping system productivity and environmental footprint, like a yield, applied input, then this provides a fantastic framework to monitor over time the impact of any technology deployment or any type of incentive that you are applying in a particular region. So we believe that there is a lot of potential for using on-farm data to complement the traditional agronomic research trying to identify causes for yield gaps. And I'm trying to convince you about that, showing some examples from Nebraska. So I'm going to talk about soybean water productivity in the Corn Belt. So there is something about that in my presentation. This is a study that we conducted about 2-3 years ago with Jessica. We spent a long winter just collecting data from farmers' fields. That was a quite interesting winter. And we basically collect that data from 500 fields across Nebraska. We are talking about only producers, irrigated and dryland fields, over 3 years, 2010, 11, and 12. So we are including a quite large variation in weather. 2010 and 11 were wet years. 2012 was a drought year. And we are, as you can see from the red dots in that map, which identify the survey fields, we have covered pretty well the range of management practices across the major soybean producing area in Nebraska. Hopefully I'm not missing anything there. This is the information that we collect from for each field, which includes, of course, the yield, some key management practices, applied inputs, and perhaps more important, we also knew the exact location of each field, so we were able to link each field with weather and soil data. So we have the power of contextualize all this information in biophysical terms. We apply the conceptual framework on water productivity developed by Passiura in the late 70s, in which grain yield is a function of the amount of water that is transpired and the efficiency by which crops convert that transpiration into yield. This framework was adapted to be used to benchmark on-farm water productivity in the mid-80s, French and Schultz, following the early Passiura work, they say, well, let's plot on-farm wheat yields against water supply, and let's take a look of the maximum yields along the range of water supplies, and let's define a boundary function. And that boundary function should match with the water productivity framework developed by Passiura early in the late 70s, with the slope of that boundary function representing the water use efficiency or transpiration efficiency or water productivity, however you want to call it, while the x-intercept represents the soil evaporation plus some amount of transpiration that needs to occur to have some minimum yield level. But the beauty of this approach is that it's very easy to use. Any farmer will know what was the in-season water supply in a particular field, and will know his/her yield level. So they can just plug the yield and water supply for a particular field, and depending how far that field is from the boundary function, he can benchmark himself and see how far he is from that line that represents the maximum yield that he can get per unit of water supply. And this framework is very nice because it's easy to use, provides an objective way to benchmark on farm water productivity, and again, it's based on biophysical principles. So we follow that approach in our soybean project, and in this figure you can see soybean yields plotted against seasonal water supply. Each of those points corresponds to an individual field year observation. The blue squares corresponds to irrigated crops. As you can see, an irrigated soybean crop in Nebraska will get on an average year about 800 millimeters of water supply. And by the way, the water supply includes both the soil water content, the available soil water content at planting, plus the in-season rain, plus irrigation. And on the more on the right hand, on the left side of that figure, you can see all the yellow circles, which corresponds to dryland fields. And you can see that the amount of water supply is quite variable because it will depend on where you are in Nebraska and which type of year you have. But if we look at the maximum yields, again, along the range of the water supply, we can define a boundary function. And the slope of that boundary function has a slope of about 9.9 kilograms per hectare per millimeter, 3.7 bushels per acre in English units. And if you multiply, I mean, if you correct that value by the composition of the seed biomass, you will get something very close to the 22 kilograms of wheat per millimeter that Victor was showing before for Australia. An interesting thing is that, with good management and with most of the water supply going into transpiration, a farmer should expect his particular field to get close to that 9.9 kilograms per hectare per millimeter. However, you can see from this figure that most of the farmers are well below that boundary function, implying that in many cases there are non-water related factors that are constraining crop yields, or in dryland fields there may be also the case that the distribution of water supply during the growing season was not optimal relative to irrigated crops. Now, if you look at that boundary function, it's also telling us that beyond 650-700 millimeters, yield is not responsive to increasing water supply. So therefore, we can categorize our fields between those that were apparently water limit versus those that were non-water limit. And this is very useful not only for a farmer, but also at district level and state level. For an individual farmer, it's important to know if he can increase his profit by cutting down irrigation without hurting yield. In the case of an irrigation district manager, it's important to know how many farmers are applying water supplies that are in excess to the water supplies that are required to achieve maximum yields, and therefore he can quantify what will be the likely impact to occur if this, or the water savings, if all these farmers that are to the right of this figure move to the left, and therefore they can cut down irrigation amounts without hurting yields, or in the case in which we eventually, in a scenario of deficit irrigation, we need to move towards water supplies that are below the 650 millimeters, then what's the likely impact that reduced water supplies below that threshold are going to have on yields? Bottom line is that this kind of information provides can help to better inform any sort of decision that has to do not only with management at the field level, but also to policy and incentives likely to be implemented at district and state levels. Keep in mind that Nebraska has the largest share of U.S. irrigated land. Therefore, there are many concerns about how it will be possible in the future to maintain such a high productivity if we are moving to a scenario of stretching water resources. Finally, another thing that is quite interesting to look at in this figure is that in some site years, both dry land and irrigated fields received or have the same water supply level. So, for example, if you look at the range between 600 and 900 millimeters, many dryland and irrigated crops are within that range. However, the irrigated crops are consistently above the rainfed crops despite they receive the same amount of water supply. So the question is why there is this intrinsic low productivity of dryland fields relative to irrigated fields? And the answer to that question is, well, first of all, dryland, typically the best land goes to irrigated crops. Therefore, the dryland crops are typically grown in the worst land within a given farm if there is access to irrigation, of course. The second reason is that Typically, a farmer will start planting their irrigated fields first, and then they will leave the dryland fields to the end. Therefore, there is a penalty there because of the late planting of dryland crops. So those dryland crops that got planted later, they will still have a lower yield, despite they have a large amount of water supply during the rest of the season. And finally, in most of the cases, dryland crops receive lower apply inputs amounts relative to irrigated crops. Bottom line is that the management of dryland crops, which is adjusted for the average year, doesn't allow these crops to capitalize the higher yield in a favorable growing season. And finally, if you are also interested about yield gaps here, you can make a further subdivision here and classify these fields not only on water limit or water excess, but also into large yield gaps and versus low yield, small yield gaps. And if you are a policymaker, if you are a crop consultant, if you are somebody who works in the water food nexus, then it's quite important to know which farmers are applying water in excess and getting large yield gaps versus those that apply water right on time, right in the right amount, and they are very close to our boundary function for water productivity. So a lot of information that we can derive from this single figure. We can go further with this and look at the causes for some of those yield gaps, that is the difference between farmer's yields and the maximum attainable yield, which was derived from that boundary function. So in this case, I'm showing here the again on-farm soybean yields plotted against sowing dates. Sowing date is shown as day of the year. Just as a reference, day of the year 120 represents May 1st, 140 represents May 30, and most of the planting takes place during May. We can also derive a boundary function there if we look at the maximum yields along the range of sowing dates. And from that boundary function, we can derive that there is a yield penalty of about 30 kilos of soybean seed per day of delay after May 1st. And if you go to a northern location in Nebraska with a shorter growing season, that penalty increases up to 52 kilograms per hectare. And again, this is very useful information. From a farmer perspective, he/she can quantify what's the opportunity cost of getting a crop planted later. So if you are a farmer in Nebraska with 10 pivots, you can multiply the 30 kilos penalty by the 130 acres that a pivot irrigated field has, times the number of pivots, and times the price of soybean, and that's going to give you a dollar value that you can compare against, for example, the cost of purchasing an additional planter to make sure to plant your soybean early enough and not having this penalty. On the other hand, this information also provides information for researchers. For example, if we are interested to decompose the yield gains observed for soybean in the United States, and we know that farmers have consistently planted earlier year after year at a rate of half day earlier per year from the 70s till now, then you can use this slope of 30 or 50 kilos and multiply it by how much in advance planting date has moved on an annual basis, and then you will get what's the contribution of this particular management factor into the overall yield gain observed for soybean in the States. So again, very useful information for not only for farmers but also for researchers and for people who make decisions at much larger scales. I'm now going to move into maize or corn, and I'm going to And by the way, this was a project that was led by one of my postdoc students, Bupinder Framaja, and Kate Boone, one of my grad students, was also part of it. And what we tried to do in this study was to start to look at the gap and at the component of the gap and try to dissect what's really the portion of that gap that can be managed, that is exploitable by farmers, and is likely or can be potentially be narrow in a cost-effective way. So every time, just to give you some context, in Nebraska, average irrigated maize yield is around 13 tons per hectare. I'm talking about producer average farm yield for irrigated corn. But every time I go to an extension meeting and I talk with farmers, the first question that comes up is why I cannot get to 20 tons per hectare, because that's what most seed companies have been promising me during the last 20 years, and because that's what record yield farmers are reporting. And therefore, why my 13 tons per hectare, despite being very high and despite being probably one of the most high yield cropping systems in the world, why is 30% below what my best neighbor can get? So I was trying to address that question in an objective and rational way, and trying to answer the question of how much of this 30% of this apparent 6 tons per hectare gap can be actually be managed, and so that farmers can move to from 13 tons to something that is higher, perhaps not 90, but something closer. Wow. So there, in few words, we can decompose the yield gap into two components. One that is related with factors that are persistent over time, and factors that are non-persistent over time. Persistent factors include, for example, choices of crop sequence, include consistent annual management. For example, a farmer who plants consistently early relative to others that plants consistently later. And on the other hand, you have non-persistent factors like weather-by-management interactions that are very, very hard to predict and very hard to manage. Therefore, in a way, the share of persistent factors of the total yield, of the overall yield gap, is going to tell us something about how much of that gap is likely to be narrowed by a farmer. But again, with recognizing that some of those persistent factors may still not be manageable, because if the persistence is just because of soils, then there is not too much that a farmer can do about that. But if the persistent factor is because of, for example, late planting date, then there is an opportunity for narrowing that gap. So again, our question is how much of that gap is due to factors that are consistent over time versus factors that are not consistent over time. And this was our methodological framework. And this is the idea. If you look at the distribution of yield gaps across all fields in a given year, and you identify those fields with the largest gap versus those fields with the smallest gap, and then you look at how those same fields behave in the rest of the years, if the factors explaining the yield gap are consistent over time, you should expect those fields to be consistently the worst and the best fields across time. In contrast, if the gap is explained by factors that are not consistent over time, therefore, those fields should go back to the regional average gap in the other years. So following this idea, we use this database collected in Nebraska, for which we have more than 2,000 fields reported in each year. In each of those years, we look at the distribution of yield gap, and we look at the upper and lower tails of the yield gap distribution, and we look at how those fields behave during the rest of the years. And bottom line, I'm not going to go into the details now, but if you look at how the yield gap compares in the year in which those fields were ranked versus the years in which those fields were not ranked, you can get an idea of how much of that yield gap is persistent versus how much of that gap is not persistent. And bottom line is that only 30 to 50% of that gap can be attributed to something that is persistent over time and likely to be possible to be managed by a farmer. And when we look at the causes behind that persistent factors, one thing that we found is that there was a higher proportion of fields, and this is for the different regions, there was a larger proportion of fields in rotation compared with continuous corn in fields with smaller yield gaps compared with fields with larger yield gaps. So that's one thing that is manageable and a farmer can decide to do to reduce the yield gap in his or her field. We also found that soil has to do with the persistent factors, and indeed those fields with the small yield gaps also exhibit better soil quality, but that's not something, a factor that can be managed by a farmer. And finally, we found that on average, farmers with small gaps were applying a bit larger amounts of nitrogen and irrigation, but despite applying more nitrogen and more irrigation, their partial efficiencies in the use of water and nitrogen were much higher relative to those fields with small yield gaps that received less inputs of nitrogen and water. So bottom line here is that if we go back to this scheme, there is only 30 to 50% of that 6 ton per hectare gap that can be exploited, and out of that 30-50 is really the true value of what can be managed there is even smaller, because there are some factors that are persistent that cannot be managed, for example, soils. So to conclude, I have more slides, but I don't have time for that. The challenge, the big challenge, besides trying to present 25 slides in 25 minutes, the biggest challenge is to feed 9+ billion people by 2050 with stretching water and land resources, and try to do that in a way that we minimize the associated environmental impact. And meeting this challenge, and this is what I think for the future, is going to be only possible if every single acre of existing cropland produces crop yields that are near the yield potential, and input applications are very fine-tuned, synchronized in time and space to match the crop requirements. And this will offer us with a fantastic opportunity for benchmarking, because if every single piece of land in this world in 20, 30 years from now has to report data to monitor environmental footprint and productive performance, then if we couple that with water and soil information, will offer us a fantastic opportunity to real-time benchmarking of productive and environmental performance of cropping systems, and try to put that in a solid special framework that allows us to look at trade-off and identify opportunities for improvement at different special scales. So thank you very much for the time. Sorry for extending a bit.